dance around the table. We dance when we're able. We do routines, we call the scenes, the footwork impeccable. We dine well here in Camelot. We eat ham and jam and spam a lot. We're knights of the round table. Our shows are for mid-table. So many times we're given rhymes that are quite unsingable. We're off the mad in Camelot. We sing from the diaphragm.
I have to push the pram a lot.
No, on second thoughts, let's not go to Camelot. It is a silly place.
Back to the bin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. I'm Paul Spataro, and I am joined here in our own little Camelot by Mr. Gene Hendricks, who hasn't been on for a while. How you doing, Gene?
Doing very well, Paul. Thank you very much for having me on now that, you know, I'm getting back into the podcasting realm. You know, released an episode of my own show last month. Starting to work in. I already have the next one planned out with a very special guest. But you'll just have to wait and hear that when it comes out.
Well, why don't you tell everybody about episode one so that maybe they'll jump onto it?
Well, it's not episode one. It's episode 20-something of the Hammer Podcast, the official podcast of thehammerstrikes.com. And something that has lied fallow for a little while, but now I'm getting a little more free time, getting back into it. So I just released an episode with Captain Entropy from Firewater fame. He's a famous letter hack over there. And we discussed something you're not supposed to talk about, religion.
Oh, my.
Because he is a devout Christian. I am most decidedly not, being a worshiper of the Norse gods. And we had a very nice back and forth. Each answering each other's questions. Went on for about an hour. There's still plenty more questions out there, so I labeled it part one.
Fair enough. Now, you would just, because it's a tangent that goes off of what you were just saying, last year my kids went on a vacation with their mom, and they went to Norway. Ooh. And while they were there, they picked up for me a 3-inch pewter statue of Thor. But it is not Thor of comic book legend. Mm-hmm. It is Thor of Norse legend. So I figured you'd be.
Is it the one where he's sitting down with a hammer between, you know, basically held right in front of him?
No, he's holding the hammer on high.
Okay, all right. Because there's a very famous statue, same thing, only about 3 or 4 inches tall, but it's Thor sitting down with a helmet on, and he's got the hammer basically sitting between his legs, and he's holding the shaft in front of him.
That would be cool too.
Yeah.
But this one I was pretty happy with this one. It's dissimilar, but it's similar enough to the Thor that I know that it's kind of cool. Mm-hmm. In both ways. So, anyway, Gene suggested that he was going to bring Camelot 3000 issue number one today. And I thought, well, what issue can I bring to be kind of a companion to that? So I did a quick Google search, and I said, King Arthur in comics. And then I saw that he was in World's Finest number 162, which I happen to own, and I happen to have bought it not that long ago, maybe within the last 2 years, for a dollar. And I had never sat down and read it. So I said, you know what? That's the book I'm going to cover. And little did I realize just how silly this issue is. So we're going to definitely get some contrast between my issue and your issue. Mine came out in November of 1966. The cover is by Kurt Swan and George Klein. It depicts Batman and Superman both in combat with an armored knight. Superman is being hit on the head by a mace, while Batman is being slashed with a sword, severing his utility belt and cutting through his bat suit, apparently revealing a shirt and tie underneath, which just seemed really strange to me. The cover text reads, "Pawns of the Jousting Master." Why does Superman fall before his mace? Batman fear his sword. What is his power? So, just starting off, just to give quick thoughts on the cover, I have long been a defender of Kurt Swan because he was the Superman artist I grew up with. And as far as the depictions of the characters, they're kind of fine, but everybody looks very, very stiff. There's no real flow to the movement on the cover, and that stands out to me as just being bothersome. So I'm not really too high on the cover, but we'll get back to that a little later. So again, the title of the issue is Pawns of the Jousting Master. It was written by Jim Shooter. Now, I started thinking as I was reading this, and we'll get into that also later, but I started thinking, how old was Jim Shooter when he wrote this? This came out in November of 66. He was born in September of 51. So that means he was 15 years old when this was published. So I find that to be just... I knew he started very, very young, but I find that to be just fascinating.
I must say, I can tell that he was 15.
Yes, that is one of the things from the story. It's penciled by Kurt Swan, inked by George Klein, edited by Mort Weisinger. The synopsis is that the splash page shows Superman flying up towards a castle in Camelot, while Batman is being flung from a trebuchet towards the castle, while both are being targeted by arrows. On the ground, King Arthur and his knights are joining the fight on foot. The narration box compares super teams, including the Knights of the Round Table. How did we get to this situation? Well, pull up an ice block and lend an ear. Superman was hanging out in the Batcave discussing a trophy from their latest adventure when an armored knight appeared before them. The knight challenged the two of them, offering to return from whence he came if they defeat him, but that they are to obey him if he's victorious. Incredulously, they accept the challenge. First, the knight takes on Superman, outmaneuvering him, deflecting his punch with his shield, and taking him out for the count with a mace to the jaw. Batman then takes to the offensive with a batarang, which does virtually nothing. He then takes a sword hilt to the jaw. In desperation, he throws a stun bomb, which also does nothing. The knight becomes invisible and uses his sword to sever a stalactite that lands on Batman and knocks him out. Score, Jousting Meister 2, World's Finest 0. He then commands them to come with him, which they do, indicating that they have no choice. Really. Anyway, they reappear in what appears to be King Arthur's court, and the Jousting Master indicates that he's actually Sir Lancelot, and that he used various methods of magical chicanery, including Merlin conjuring up a tiny chunk of kryptonite in order to defeat the duo. They're told that aliens came to Camelot and used some strange power to make them doubles of King Arthur, Merlin, and six knights, and drove them from Camelot. Now Batman and Superman are being asked to help them to overtake Camelot. A battle ensues, which recreates the circumstances of the splash page, including Batman being able to maneuver his body in midair to avoid a rain of arrows coming towards him. Once the initial siege of the castle is completed, the two set of mirror images face off against each other. Batman and Superman work with their newfound allies and manage to take the castle. Unfortunately, all is not as it appears, as King Arthur sentences the defeated group to death by electrocution. Being the master detective that he is, Batman deduces that King Arthur couldn't possibly know anything about electricity, and the two heroes soon learn that they've helped the duplicates triumph over the originals. The heroes quickly remedy the situation, with Superman using his super breath to cause the faux King Arthur to drop his faux Excalibur, severing the chains holding the real knights, who make quick work of defeating the alien doppelgangers. At this, the aliens admit that they are beaten and will leave Earth. Once again, in a potentially foolish show of faith, Superman accepts this as fact and somehow frisbees the alien craft, stating that they'll never menace the Knights again. Now with the adventure over, Batman and Superman are ready to return to their own time, but first are knighted as Sir Batman and Sir Superman, Knights of the Round Table. Yeah. Written by a 15-year-old? I would say so. This is... My quick criticism of the cover art carries over to the story. Unfortunately, I felt like everybody was very undynamic in their movements. They didn't feel that to be that quick flow to it. I've commented in the past how certain artists have their characters looking like they're in motion at all times. Gene Colan was like the master of that, and this is just the anti Gene Colan. Everybody looks very stiff. Nobody really looks like they're moving. The layouts, the alien look is just not particularly original feeling. I'm not happy with the artwork. The story is just all kinds of silly. I mean, it's just, you know, there's so many things in here where you scratch your head. And I tried to point out a couple of them in the synopsis, like why they would even agree to these battle terms with the Knight when he shows up is beyond me. And then saying, well, we have no choice, we have to do whatever he says. Well, what if he told you to kill somebody? Mm-hmm. Do you have a choice now? You know, there's things like that happen. And then, you know, even in the battle, like I said, there's a point when Batman is flying through the air and they're shooting arrows at him, and he's actually twisting around and managing to make all the arrows miss him while he's flying through the air. I mean, no.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you look at every panel in this, and it's almost like there was a photographer standing there saying, okay, hold it, take a picture, move on to the next one. You're right. Everyone is just standing around. There are times when, you know, Batman's just standing there, just looking. It's like, okay, yeah, something's going on. I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to stand here and watch it.
That seems to be a very common pose, isn't it? That Batman standing at the foreground while the action's going on beyond him?
Yes. Now, I will give Jim Shooter this. There are some good accuracies in this as far as the King Arthur stuff goes. All of the knights that are named are actual Arthurian knights. Even the ones that, you know, Sir Bohort, I believe, is one of them. And that's a knight from well before Mallory, actually. All of their stuff, you know, none of them have magical items. And Lancelot doesn't have invincible armor. Kay doesn't have an invisibility cloak. But Gawain, while he doesn't have a belt that does this, he did possess the ability that his strength in the morning increased until noon, where he was two or three times stronger than the average knight. So he only was unable to defeat like six knights in battle. But then in the afternoon, his strength went back down.
You need a cup of coffee then.
Yeah, well, the story goes that Gawain, who is Arthur's nephew, by the way, was baptized at noon as an infant, which is something as in the 6th century you didn't do. You were baptized as an adult. So he was baptized as a child, and that conferred magical properties on him. And since he was baptized at noon, the time of the baptism was when he was at the highest strength every day. So the fact that Shooter worked that stuff in, and also the fact that the round table is just a circle. It isn't, there's an open space in the middle. That is the same in the legends, because you're supposed to have servants or whatever in the center giving, you know, refilling drinks or bringing food or whatnot, and the knights sit around the outside. So, for that, he did a good job. But the plot, I don't know.
Well, you know, I'll give Jim Shooter credit for being better than the average 15-year-old at putting a story together. But he had not reached the point of his brain maturing enough to do, you know, a more sophisticated story. I am very interested in King Arthur's legend. I've seen several movies, I've read a couple of things, but I am far from an expert on it. I think you're far more familiar with the legend than I am. But I have in the past and continue to enjoy stories of King Arthur, whether it's, you know, the Sword in the Stone, you know, cartoon, or if it's, you know, the movie Excalibur, and other forms that I've seen over the years. But again, I'm not an expert on it. I just find it to be enjoyable, put it that way. I didn't think King Arthur was particularly well portrayed in this. I don't think they gave him any sort of distinct, other than the fact that he's carrying Excalibur. I don't think that they really distinguished him from just random king that I wrote into a story.
Yeah, and well, part of the problem is that the vast majority of the time we're spending with King Arthur, it's an alien disguise. So what his mannerisms are supposed to be, I don't know. But yeah, you're right. It's just, yeah, the only, I think the real King Arthur says two lines in the entire thing. And so, yeah, you don't really get much to it. But what really came off as weird in this story, and I haven't read a huge amount of World's Finest, so I don't know if this is normally the case, but it was Superman and his sidekick Batman. Because Superman agrees to the challenge. Superman's the one who says, oh, we have no choice but to follow him. Superman somehow recognizes King Arthur when they meet. I'm mistaken. It's Batman that recognizes King Arthur. And that there's a reason for that. Batman met King Arthur in Batman number 11.
Oh, I did not know that. See, you know more about King Arthur than me.
But it's like, you know, Superman's doing all this stuff, and Batman's just hanging around. It's like, okay, yeah. Well, he's busy over there. I guess I should load myself into this catapult and shoot myself up to the top of the wall. It's like, what?
Yeah, why not?
If you consider the time period, because this was, what month did this come out? Because you said 66, so what?
It was November, it was cover dated November of 66, so it probably came out in September, I would guess.
So this is just before the Adam West show premiered. If you want to put yourself in the mindset of where Batman was at that time. So, yeah, I mean, I can see where this would fit with those kind of stories, you know, more fantastical kind of thing. It's a shame Robin isn't here, but...
Well, Robin was, you know, he was in some World's Finest, he wasn't in some others. I think he's actually listed on the cover as being in here. Yeah, it says Batman with Robin the Boy Wonder, but he's not... doesn't appear in this one.
I think that's just the logo. It always has with Robin the Boy Wonder. But yeah,
he would frequently appear in some World's Finest issues, but it was sporadic. You never knew if you were going to get him or not, unless he was on the cover. Then you knew.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what happens in this story is just because the plot needs it to do it. Like, you know, them agreeing, no questions asked. Yeah, we'll take up your challenge. And then, we'll follow you and do whatever you say.
and of course, we can go back in time without any problem.
Yeah, well, it's Merlin, of course. But what really gets me is they're given this story, right, of these aliens, and it's the truth, that these aliens come in, they take the forms of the king and the knights of the Round Table, and then they fight. And but the one side is kicked out. But then, and this is the actual quote, seeing us defeated, my armies joined them. Really? You're believing someone that's saying that his loyal knights just saw him get defeated once and said, now go to the other side. Come on.
Yeah, that is, again, like you say, it just fits the plot. You know, whatever the plot needed, that's what happened.
Yeah, exactly. I'm glad I read it, but I wasn't coming back to it.
This fits what I've said about a lot of the DC Silver Age stuff. I can read it and I can enjoy it for what it is in small doses. But if I try to do too much at once, my patience wears thin.
Right.
I need to just sporadically give myself... See, you know, we were talking before we were recording about, you know, being completists and, you know, reading, like, things in bunches. I can't really do that with Silver Age DC. I can't do it with Golden Age anything, honestly. I can read issues here and there, and I can keep coming back to it, and I can enjoy them. But if I try to read too many in a row... Again, my patience wears thin, and I just walk away from it at that point.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, Silver Age, like you said, you can do that occasionally. I've gone back and I tried reading Action Comics from number one and going on, as I'm not just reading the Superman story, reading the whole thing. And it's like, okay, well, it takes me multiple nights to read one issue. Because there's so much packed in there. But then you get to the point where it's like, oh, I don't like this. The way they're doing this certain thing. And it's like, do I want to keep going with that? Or, you know, just put it aside and maybe I'll come back to it in a month or so. You know, but yeah, Silver Age, you can do a couple that's, nah, I need a break.
Although I can do Silver Age Marvel in bunches, because Silver Age Marvel progressed more quickly than DC.
Yeah.
And then DC stayed in the Silver Age kind of through most of the 70s. You had exceptions. They had, you know, stories that were more sophisticated and storylines that would be more sophisticated. But on a whole, they continued to have silly stories, or to be a little bit more fair about how I'm phrasing it, stories designed for younger people well into the 70s.
Yeah.
Whereas Marvel, I think, in the 60s realized, you know what? We want to start targeting college students. We want to start, you know, I don't know if they thought much beyond college. I don't know if they expected middle-aged men to be reading these books, you know, in the 2000s. But certainly they were definitely looking for a more sophisticated audience than 12-year-olds.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. You know, the Marvel stuff, it's... Once Stan got that... Once he got the Marvel Pop Art Productions thing going on, it was... You had more continuing stories. You had... just looking at the Fantastic Four, you had inter-team conflict. The Justice League wouldn't argue the way the Thing and the Human Torch would argue. Excuse them.
And for anybody listening, that's Gene's dogs.
Because I'm talking to someone. Therefore, they must be in the same room and be loud. But, you know, once you got into the more... I'm not going to say realistic, but more adult ideas behind things and, you know, motivations and stuff like that... Yeah, then, you know, you compare that to DC at the same time, and yeah, it's like, okay, this is written for older teenagers, early 20s, this is written for preteens.
Yeah, pretty much. And again, I, you know, even as I'm not even, you know, middle-aged anymore. I'm ready to brand myself as senior. But I can still read some of this, you know, the stuff that's designed for the younger kids and really enjoy it. But again, when it's the younger it's skewed, the more I have to limit my exposure to it before I start to get tired of it. Even, you know, some of that early Marvel stuff, you know, it's like Stan developed a formula, and sometimes he played that formula to death. You know,
yeah.
Everybody had to have their one fatal flaw. Everybody had to have the woman who was in love with their hero identity, but not so much in their civilian identity. And then sometimes you'd twist it around where they'd fall in love with the civilian. I remember that like really clearly in Iron Man, where Pepper Potts was in love with Tony Stark but hated Iron Man.
Right.
And then something happened where she felt Tony wasn't being fair to Iron Man, and she started becoming an Iron Man supporter and disliking Tony. You know, it's just like, you know, that formula wore thin after a while, but it still was better than no formula at all.
Right, yeah. Yeah, if you... Cap moaning about how Bucky's dead and all and everything, every issue, is still, you know, on the whole better than just, oh, we're, you know, we're going to defeat, you know, Felix Faust today. Everyone split up into teams. And...
yeah, but you know, when I rate these books, like this book, what I try to do is I try to put myself into the shoes of the audience that they're meant to go to, which, you know, this is 1966. I would have been a little too young to read this, but say about 4 years afterwards, this would have been, I would have been in the target audience. So I try to think about if I was reading it at that point, if I was 9, 10 years old, 8 years old, whatever. But you know, what would I have thought of this story? And I would have liked it. I'm sure I would have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so 15-year-old Jim Shooter could have written for 8-year-old Paul Spataro. And the artwork, you know, it is definitely serviceable for that type of story as well. You know, this is going to be appealing to the same Paul Spataro that would be reading Sad Sack and Richie Rich.
Yeah, I can see that. I want to check something real quick, and I'm just wondering what Kurt Swan was doing at this same time, because we know he's a better artist than this. All right, so this was 66.
Well, he would have also probably been doing Superman and Action Comics.
Right. All right, so around this same time, let me see. Yeah, so he's doing Adventure Comics, Superboy, World's Finest, Superman, and that's it.
Action Comics?
No, there's Action Comics, yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. And also Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen.
So I mean, that's a full slate.
It is. So I would say that this was probably one of those that was lower on his priority list. You know, I mean, think of Kirby, right? When Kirby was doing Fantastic Four, Thor, Hulk, you know, all these things, if he wasn't interested in the subject matter, you could tell in the comic. Like, Fantastic Four and Thor, always his top-of-the-line work. But if he had to draw something where it's, do I have to do Iron Man this month, really?
Well, a lot of those you'd see he would do, like, the basic layouts and then right. Walk away from it and let somebody else take over.
Yeah. So I'm thinking that this was kind of on that level on Swan's, like, okay, I just got to get it done. So he just rips through it. Not that the art is bad. It's just not up to the, you know, Superman Red, Superman Blue. You know, that's some really good art, dynamic art. This isn't.
Now I'm just curious, and I'm sure neither of us have an actual answer to this other than a possible opinion. Do you think he did just a quick art job, and that's why it looks the way it does? And again, it's not that it's horrible, but you know, it's not as sophisticated as it could be. Or do you think he did less with the art and then left it up to George Klein to kind of take it? And this is, you know, we're seeing a lot more of George Klein here.
that could be. I mean, just flipping through this, I'm seeing on the close-ups of like Superman. Okay, yeah, that's Kurt Swan. But if you just see him, if Superman or Batman have to be in the background, it's almost like, oh, that's just a standard thing. So it's possible that Klein did a lot of the heavy lifting on this. You're right. Yeah.
And I'm not particularly familiar with Klein, so I can't even say if this is worse than what he normally would do, better than what he would normally do. This right. is typical for him. I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, I don't know either. I'm familiar with the name, but I couldn't pick his art out, you know, just by looking at it.
Yeah, I'm pretty much in the same exact boat. So, anything else about this one, or should we just rate it?
I think we can safely rate it.
All right, so now the cover. I'm trying to, again, put myself into the, you know, 8 to 12-year-old mode and try and think of what I would think of this at that time. I think, more or less, I wouldn't necessarily be excited by it, but I also wouldn't be turned off by it. If I was sitting somewhere and my mom said, you know, sit and read a comic while we're waiting for the dentist or whatever, mm-hmm. and I picked this up, I'd be more or less happy with it. If I was in the candy store and she said, you know, here's 20 cents, go pick out a comic, or 12 cents, you go pick out a comic, I don't know that this is the one I would pick. Probably not. But it's, yeah, I mean, the cover is okay. My biggest problem with it, as we've mentioned a couple of times already, is everybody seems a little too static. There doesn't seem to be a fluidity to their motion at all, especially the Knight. He's whacking Superman over the head with a mace, and it looks like he's, you know, like he's doing that without any thought or real movement at all. He's swinging the sword. There doesn't seem to be any energy in what he's doing. I'm going to say a C. Just, you know, it's okay. It's not horrible, but it's not good either. And I think that's exactly what I'm going to carry over to the interior art. A C. It's acceptable. It's no more, no less. It's average storytelling. The story is very silly. But I do think, again, young preteen Paul would have gotten a kick out of it, and I think I would have enjoyed reading it. So for that reason, I'm going to kick it up half a grade, and I'm going to give it a C+. I think it's, you know, I think the target audience would enjoy it. So overall, I'm going to even give the book a pump up for that and give the book a C+, because in this instance, again, with a preteen audience, I think the story is probably more important than the art in that respect. So I'm going to say a C+ overall.
All right, yeah, I'm right with you on the cover as a C. It is doing what a cover should do, shows you what's in the story, but that's about it. And I every time I look at it, I'm like, okay, in order for this knight to be, which is Lancelot, as we find out in the story, in order for him to be doing these two motions at the same time, he would have had to start with his arms all the way behind his head, if you follow those motion lines. As, okay, so they're just going to stand there and let him do this and swing at them? I don't know. I understand what they're going for. It's, oh, this person's besting both of them. But yeah, it's just not composed in a way I would like. Yeah, the art on the inside, same thing. It's a C. It's telling the story. You don't have to read anything to know what's going on. You know, it does that job. But it's, like I said before, it's just a bunch of photographer poses, and that's it. Now, I'm going to give this a little bit higher on the story itself. I'm going to give it a B-. Because of the accuracies from the Arthurian stuff that Shooter put in. I mean, he had to have had a book or something from a family member, or he went and got it out of the library to get the names right, to know Gawain's... he could have just said, oh, Gawain's got a belt of strength, but to know that he gets stronger as the morning goes on, I give him a little props for that. But I think overall, I'll give it a C+ on the entire book.
Now, something I forgot to mention already that I'm just going to bring up is one of the inaccuracies, as far as I'm concerned, is if he had kryptonite to weaken Superman, and then he smashed him in the head with a mace, wouldn't that be enough to crack his skull? Because he's depowered from the kryptonite?
Maybe. I'm not super familiar how kryptonite at this time period worked. Does it just weaken him? Does it take away his powers? I don't know. We would have to call in Scott or Dave for an expert opinion.
All right. Well, we're going to throw that on the table for them to let us know when they listen to this episode.
Yes.
Whenever that may be.
We'll hear from them in 5 years.
So, to get off the silliness now, we're going to go to where we originally started, which is Camelot 3000, Gene's book.
All right. So, this is issue number 1 of 12, a maxi series. Cover day of December of 1982. On sale date September 16th of 1982. Story by Mike W. Barr. Pencils, Brian J. Bolland. Inks, Bruce D. Patterson. Apparently it was everyone with a middle initial month. Letters, John Costanza. Colors, Tatiana Wood. And your editor was Len Wein. On the cover, we have King Arthur walking towards the reader, holding aloft Excalibur, while green creatures shoot at a blonde teenager behind him, and Merlin the Magician is looming over everything. The splash page shows Arthur holding aloft Excalibur again. Behind him are the heads of Merlin, a blonde woman, and a brunette man. There are also 6 hands holding up swords and a spaceship flying on the other side. The title of the issue, written on a parchment, is The Past and Future King. We open in London, England. We know this because we see Big Ben. In the year 3000, the city is under attack by alien invaders. An old man and his younger companion seek shelter from the destruction while lamenting that there is no chance of escaping the city. We then cut to Tom Prentice and his parents attempting to do that very thing. Unfortunately, their hover car is shot down, with only Tom surviving. He runs from the wreck to Glastonbury Tor, where he enters an archaeological dig site, closely followed by the aliens. Our scene shifts to Paris, which we know because we see the Eiffel Tower, and Jules Futrelle, who is trying to help as many English refugees as he can. This does nothing to help the uselessness of the world's richest man feels, though, as he knows that Earth needs to start a counterattack. Back inside the Tor, Tom runs through the tunnels, trying to stay ahead of the aliens. He manages to run face first into what he thinks is a rock. When he lashes out with his futuristic crowbar, though, he uncovers an inscription. It's written in Latin, but Tom translates it to read, "Here lies buried the renowned King Arthur, once and future king." With nowhere else to go...
I got nowhere else to go! I got nothing else.
Tom opens the sarcophagus, and shockingly, someone comes out of it. And that would be Paul's dog. The man, Arthur Pendragon, asks how long he's been asleep, but the conversation is interrupted by the aliens. Arthur picks up the crowbar and wields it like a sword. He kills 2 of the aliens with his makeshift weapon, then dispatches the last with a shot from a purloined blaster. Tom fills Arthur in on just how long he's been out of commission. Arthur is pleased both that the wound Mordred gave him is healed, and that the legend of the Round Table is still known, even 2,400 years later. Arthur leads Tom out of the Tor, where he dispatches two more aliens and takes their ship. They head to Stonehenge to find Merlin. Cutting to North America, most likely NORAD, since they have a big board, where Commander Joan Acton is supervising a losing battle of her forces against the aliens. She's incredibly frustrated that they can't effectively fight back against the menace. On the way to Stonehenge, Tom fills Arthur in on recent history. Recent, in quotes. Centuries ago, all but three of the world's governments voted to cease space programs, turning the world isolationist. Don't ask me where the new 420 countries came from. The current invaders took advantage of the lack of defenses to come in and attempt to take over. Before any more exposition, you would think that someone who wrote this would know how to say it. Before any more exposition can be laid out, the pair arrives at Stonehenge. Tom explains that the only reason this place is untouched, even though space is at a premium, is that the machinery would stop working and the men would get sick any time they try to demolish the ancient monument. Arthur laughs, as he knows this is all Merlin's doing. He then calls out to his old mentor, but is greeted by spirits who call him a pretender and usurper. Arthur, getting angry, slams the probar into a rock at the center of the ring, which frees Merlin from the prison that Nivaine, a Lady of the Lake, put him in. Merlin explains that he was able to arrange for Tom to find Arthur, and now the king must unite the nations of Earth to fight the menace. Merlin teleports all three of them to Salisbury Downs nuclear plant, where the Lady of the Lake, presumably not the one that imprisoned Merlin, appears in the cooling water and throws Excalibur to Arthur. The sword disappears, however, annoying Arthur. Merlin says that the sword will show itself soon, as will the Knights of the Round Table. We cut to the United Nations, which somehow is another 297 countries added, and a reporter narrates how a sword stuck in a stone and anvil has just forced its way through the floor of the General Assembly. Next, the sword and the stone. So, yeah, this is a little less silly than the other one, but it's still King Arthur fighting aliens, which I find very interesting.
I bought this new off the stands, or from the comic store, where I had a pull list at the time, and I loved it. I loved this series, and if my memory is right, I got the first 11 issues, and then there was a year delay before the 12th issue came out. And during that year, I stopped buying comics for a few years. And then I had a tough time finding issue 12 when the time came. I did eventually find it and completed the collection. And then I also have the, the deluxe edition that I flashed to Gene at the screen while he was reading. I really enjoyed this story. I just thought this was... You know, my initial thought was to say it was cinematic, which it does have that element to it. But I kind of felt, rereading issue one, and I'm going to see if it carries through as I read more of them, but I felt like it was more of a serial type thing with a cliffhanger ending, which eventually became more popular in things like Walking Dead and Why the Last Man, and, you know, it seemed to be the way that they would do those so that... You were hanging on edge waiting for the next issue, much like they would do in the serial shows that they did. I kept waiting and waiting, and then issue 11 came out, and I was waiting for issue 12, and then just didn't come. So it was a strange thing, but it's nice to be able to do all of them now. I really like the Brian Boland art. I think he's got a very good sense of storytelling and the way he puts things together. I'm not quite as big a fan of his facial renderings as I thought I was. Some of them, you know, it's a little inconsistent as far as the faces go. But the actual anatomy all seems good. His aliens seem good. And again, his storytelling is really solid. This is essentially one of these books that you could pick it up if you didn't read English and look through it and you still pretty much know what the story is. I don't think that you'd be missing a lot without the dialogue. And that's not to say that the dialogue and the story aren't important. Obviously they are. But when the pictures can carry the story as well, that's usually a great sign. And again, it has a cinematic / serial feel to it. So it's generally each issue, if I remember right, I just reread the first so far, but I remember each issue being a fairly quick read. But that wasn't because there wasn't a fair amount of story in them. I think it's because Mike Barr and Brian Bolland really did create a page turner here, where you go through it quick because you're enjoying reading it so much and you want to see what happens next. So I don't know if I'm already spoiling things of how much I enjoyed this.
Yeah, from what I remember, having read this couple years ago, I want to say, you're right. It is a cliffhanger at the end of every issue. So yeah, you got that movie serial Flash Gordon, Buck Rogers kind of feel to it. I can see what you're saying about the faces, but you know, some of them are just like when Merlin shows up. The face he's making on that, because he Axel does not agree, but you know, he bursts out of Stonehenge and he is 30 feet tall, and you know, you have been heard, Arthur, son of Uther, and answered by Merlin, son of the devil, because Merlin's father was supposedly a demon. And yeah, that the look on Merlin's face there, and then his smugness immediately after, like, hey, I knew what I was doing. I really enjoyed this. I'm tipping my hand, but it's another thing where, just like Jim Shooter got some stuff right, Mike Barr really got things right in this series. For example, like, you know, you had mentioned watching Excalibur. At the end of that movie, Mordred and Arthur are facing off, and Mordred has a spear and Arthur has Excalibur. Well, in the actual legends, it's the reverse. Mordred has gotten Excalibur, and when Arthur runs him through with a spear, he hits Arthur on the head. Which is why when Arthur is feeling that the wound is healed, it's on the right side of his head. It's, you know, that's not something you see in most adaptations. Plus, Arthur's a redhead. The legendary Arthur was a redhead. So it's the little things that I truly appreciate. And we're gonna see how, if we. You know, anyone reads further issues in this, you will see how right he gets the knights when they show up. But, you know, Merlin being kind of a trickster and teaching Arthur a lesson, being cryptic about stuff, Arthur being a hothead, all this is right on. And what I really like is that the aliens aren't just human with a different skin color or a silly thing on the bridge of their nose. They're truly alien. They have green skin, but their limbs are extremely thin. They only have two toes on each foot. They're digigrade, like, you know, a dog's leg. Their heads are much bigger than you would think for their bodies. They're truly alien, and they never speak English. It's all some weird script. So, you know, they're even trying to communicate. They're just talking to each other. They don't care about humans. They're just going to kill them. And, you know, until this guy from the 6th century shows up and whips their butts.
You know, you know, you mentioned that he gets it all right with the knights. I remember enjoying, and we're going to, obviously, not, it doesn't happen in this issue, but I remember enjoying that he gets the knights right, but decided to add a twist to the way he presents them.
Yes.
and I think that's one of the things that was most fun about as this series goes on. If anybody listening hasn't figured out that Gene and I like this issue, then you're really not listening.
Right.
And we were talking before this, and we decided we're going to do issues 2 through 12 in the coming months. So I hope that people listening have either read this story and enjoyed it and would look forward to us doing it. But if you haven't, I would strongly recommend seeking it out and reading it along with us, because this is a good series. This is a fun series. And if you know, if you're deeply into the King Arthur legend, as Gene is closer to than me, you'd enjoy this. If you just find the King Arthur legend to be really cool, but you're not so learned about it like I am, it's just as enjoyable. Yeah. So I'm strongly recommending that you pick this up. I hope I'm not ruining this for our grades when we're done talking about it.
Yeah, I agree. If anyone, even if you're only familiar with a few names, King Arthur, Merlin, Guinevere, Lancelot, that's everything else you will get from the series. Just knowing those names will be enough. And, you know, as I've indicated, if you have a deeper knowledge, then there's going to be all these little things that you pick up on. It's, oh, that's great. I remember reading about that. Oh, I heard about this. So, what I think I like best about the series overall is you see what's going to happen. Anyone with a knowledge of the general King Arthur story knows what's going to happen at certain points. And so do the characters. And they still can't stop it. But the writing around that is great. The way you see these interactions, the way Arthur handles the problem of not only the aliens, but the world governments. Like I said, there's a massive amount of countries. It's like, if you took every subsection of every country and still split it up, you wouldn't have as many countries as are on the Earth during this. It's insane. It's like, right now, I believe the United States has 100, or not the Earth, has 135 recognized countries, and they have 912 in the United Nations at the end of this issue. It's like, where did you get all these other countries? Like, no current, like, Russia would have to be split into like 300 parts just to come close to this. It's nuts. But, you know, that's another thing where you have all the infighting of, you know, you think the world politics bad now. Multiply that by 9 and see where you're at.
Yeah, but it's... Well, that's part of the fun of this, is just kind of seeing how they play it out, seeing what they do. And as you said, just the kind of the layers of the futuristic post-apocalyptic world combined with the legend of King Arthur and the inevitability of certain things happening, or, you know, history repeating itself, so to speak. There's just so much there that's fun to go through, and I'm looking forward to doing, you know, the issues, because we don't have quite enough subset Back to the Bins things that we do. So we needed to add another one to the list. So Camelot 3000 is the latest addition to that. Again, just kind of focusing on the Brian Boland art a little bit. I always appreciate when an artist ventures off of the comfort level of just kind of having standard pages and changes the panel sizes and angles and different things to kind of create a sense of motion and a sense of continuity of the story. And I feel like Bolin does that here. He also occasionally lets one panel break into another with, you know, what's going on, which is also kind of cool when it happens, and usually also lends itself to kind of the story flowing a little bit. So like I said, while I did criticize some of his facial renderings, that is really the most minor of criticisms, because I just think the art in this is excellent, and I think the story blows away the art. So this is just, you know, I can't put enough superlatives on this.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's he uses the panels in a way that gives you the pace of the story. Like, you, the big moments, it's a full page or a half a page, but then he'll have smaller panels if it's, oh, this is a tense moment where you get, you know, things are happening all at once, and it's just really, really well done. Rather than heap more praise on it, why don't we just get to grading?
Sure. Your book, so I'm going to let you go first.
All right, so cover, this is one that if I had a poster of it, would be up on the wall, so it is an A-plus to me. You look at it, and it's like, bang. This is exactly what's going to happen in the book. I want to pick this up. I was a little young to pick it up on the stands, but as soon as I heard about it, I was like, yes, I'm going back and I'm getting that. Interior artwork, I'm going to say the same, A+. It is just going through, like we were saying, the layouts, the action, the posing, in my opinion, some of the facial expressions, just really tell the story. The design of the aliens is wonderful. The deaths of some of the aliens is rather horrific. And, you know, picture them like Klingon blasters. You know, Klingon disruptors do not have a mercy setting. You feel yourself disintegrating. And that's what happens to these aliens when Arthur shoots them with their own gun. And yeah, A+ on the story too. I know where this is going, but even if I didn't, if, you know, thinking back to when I first read issue one all on its own, then yeah, it is just terrific. He's got Merlin's personality down, Arthur's personality, the whole setup with knowing the fact that Arthur was injured on the head, and one of the ladies of the lake imprisoned Merlin. It's just wonderful. So yes, A+ for everything, including the book as a whole.
Okay, I'm going to say, I'm going to agree with you on the cover, A+. This is a poster image, but it is the poster image that also shows you what's going on inside the book, which is the double, you know, it's the double plus, because when it's a poster image that just shows our main guy, you know, striking a pose, that's not good enough for me. That's a great, you know, it could be a great poster, but it's not a great comic cover as far as I'm concerned. This is an A+ comic cover. This, when I saw it back in 1982, I wanted to pick it up, and I still love it. The interior art, I'm going to just drop it from A+ to A, because there were a couple of the images where I was like not totally crazy about it. But overall, I think it's an outstanding art job. And the story is compelling. It fits the legend. It does everything you could possibly ask. It's makes you want to pick up the next issue. The cliffhanger is great. Again, it feels combination of cinematic and serial. So the story is an A+, and overall the book is an A+. My criticisms of some of the faces is not enough to drop it off an A+. So it makes me say, "Ooh, Gene, when can we talk again to do issues 2 and 3?"
Well, I got some free time coming up, so let's get going.
Yeah, it shouldn't be too long from now. We're going to definitely go through this. It's only 12 issues total, so from this point we're going to do 2 issues at a pop, so that's really six more issues, because we'll do two, and then issue 12 we'll do one, you know, an episode on its own. So six more after this. And I can't tell you how much I'm looking forward to it. Gene, thank you for making me pick up this series again, because I hadn't read it in a number of years, and it's every bit as rewarding as it was the first time.
Well, I hope the listeners enjoy it as much as we did.
Thank you for making the time to come on with me, and we'll get back together soon. So thank you, everybody, for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
See you, everyone.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiManzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.